This is Eric Hess with the Encrypted Economy. This week, we have Victor, the founder of Humanode, on our podcast. Now, despite the innovation in proof-of-stake and proof-of-work mechanisms, there are inherent limitations in each, as we all know. Proof-of-stake is largely analogous to shareholder voting in a company. It's familiar, and it's one approach to governance. Now, we also had Richard Yan from Veet Labs a while ago on the podcast, where we talked about proof-of-stake models and how to scale them. One of the innovations we talked about was quadratic voting, which is one tool to equalize voting between large token holders on one side and smaller holders on the other. As you start to approach more egalitarian voting models, which the value of which can be dependent on the individual project, they start to run the risk of abuse or even a Sybil attack, whereby an actor could take control of a network or a voting system on a network by forging identities. And this could be executed through an army of bots. It's not all that hard to spin up or to execute. So very excited about having Victor on the podcast to talk about the use of biometrics to validate that the node is, in fact, a human. And the model also has other implications then for their monetary system, known as FATH, which Victor discusses. Victor is a unique blend of developer and economist. So be prepared for a discussion that spans not only human node validation and biometrics, but privacy and macroeconomics. So if you like this episode, please share it. We continue to pick up more and more supporters every week and listeners, so it's exciting. But get it out to one person in your network who you think would benefit from it. We got a lot of content, so I think it'd be a good share. Anyway, I think you're really going to enjoy this episode with Victor, founder of Humanode. So this is Eric Hess with the Encrypted Economy, and I'm so excited today to have Victor from Humanode on the podcast. At a high level, Humanode can prove the identity of users through a novel authentication schemes and grant permission to launch a node and verify transactions running through a network based on human existence. It aims to create a solution to the plutocratic systems created with modern proof-of-stake and proof-of-work networks. This validation alternative uses the combination of proof-of-uniqueness and proof-of-existence, but I am going to let Victor explain that during the course of this podcast. So with all that said, Victor, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Eric. It's a pleasure to be here, especially hearing your recent podcast where you dive really deep into the topics of law and economics of crypto.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thanks so much. So before we get into it, why don't you tell us about your background and what brought you to where you are today?
Well, sure. I was born in Moscow. I'm not there anymore, though, but I lived there for the whole of my life. Was born in a middle-class family. And actually, probably this is why I've been mostly interested in economics since I was 12 years old, because I couldn't believe like how volatile the economy is and why so many people suffer because of it. Eventually, I got to the university to study economics on the international level and macroeconomics in particular. And, you know, never wanted to become a consultant or a banker. I was creating startups since the university times with Dato, my co-founder at Humanode. And eventually, we ended up creating more than 10 projects or supporting them from the very beginning. But in 2016, when, you know, crypto was not finally only about sending transactions, but Ethereum was launched, we said, okay, we understand its full potential now. And we basically sold everything we had from traditional IT businesses and went fully crypto. But without starting the company right away, that would be too stupid to think that, you know, we're ready to go like that. And we started a research institute, which is still working. Funny thing that back in 2016, we called it Paradigm until, you know, many others Paradigm emerged in crypto industries. And well, we were researching crypto all through it, publishing reports on a daily basis. That's what we still do, looking for new things out there. We ended up establishing a proof of stake company when Tezos launched, and many, many other networks followed the lead. And well, back in 2017, and now I'm already talking about Humanoid, we already understood that despite the fact that all these networks are called decentralized, the actual decision makers who decide on how the protocol will evolve, what are the rules of the protocol, and when you get to proof of stake, now the big validators even decide on emission schedules and amounts. We understood that, well, it is still very centralized, and if you look at it, it is even more centralized than the current US dollar global economy. So we understood that there should be a solution where one human can set up only one node to make it fully distributed, but we had no idea how to do that back then in 2017. Well, last year, you know, looking through all the researches that we were doing, not only in crypto, but in other convergent sciences, so to say, because all of those fields will eventually converge. And a little bit later, I would tell you why, for example, the general artificial intelligence can't exist with the solution like we're proposing, and it will just destroy us. Well, we went on to create the first crypto biometric protocol because we saw the increases in accuracy of biometrics, and especially a new thing in biometrics called liveness detection. So when we understood their potential and the fact that they can provide eventually even more security than current capital-based solutions can, we finally started to make our dream come true and building a network where one human can have only one node. So in short, that's our story, the story of our life.
Excellent. So that's very exciting when you think about it, particularly when you run the risks of even bots becoming involved in the governance process and the way that could be distorted. And so it seems like Humanoid really is aimed at sort of, in many ways, achieving the vision that even like Vitalik Buterin in his recent postings on it raised, the vision that maybe proof of stake doesn't exactly work due to some of the issues in terms of it distorting the governance process. I hope to talk more about that on this podcast. So Humanoid is broken into a few different segments. It's certainly a big undertaking. One is known as the Vortex. The other one is known as FATH. I might even be missing a couple, but maybe if you could give us a little bit of background on each of those, that'd be great.
Sure. Well, basically, Vortex is how we call our decentralized autonomous organization. And FATH is the economic theory that we also created a few years ago. I would say it's not a theory, it's a hypothesis, because it has never been tested out before. And this is a new way how we could structure a crypto economy and incentivize all the people in it, essentially fighting the devaluation of the token holders in comparison to active token holders who participate in governance. Well, I would start, okay, if we start from the Vortex. So we still have to stress out what technology such a DAO where one human equals one node is based on. And this is all about biometrics. A little bit of intro into biometrics. Think about this. It stands on two main pillars. One of those is search and matching. That's basically when you have a database of encrypted biometric templates of people's faces. And I should tell that eventually we will use many other modalities, but facial recognition for now is the most accurate one. And the other pillar is called liveness detection. It can tell whether this is like exactly the same person in front of the camera, because this is what search and matching does. And liveness detection gives us the possibility to find out if this is a real human being in front of the camera, or this is a spoofed identity, like created out of nowhere through deepfakes, or through wax figures, or through 3D masks that you can print already even at your home. And basically, that's how we find out, with lots of encryption layers in order for people to stay private while using this technology, if it's the same person in front of the camera, and if this person is unique, and if it's a living human being, not a created identity. So the thing about our decentralized organization is that we want to, well, basically we're building a financial network. And to have a really distributed financial network, you should have more and more people involved in it, right? But unfortunately, for now, we don't have the consensus mechanisms that allow for millions of people becoming nodes and, you know, validating transactions in the network, because it would make the network unusable. I mean, it will be slow, it will crash. And for now, thanks to like recent advances in consensuses made by the researchers who created, for example, Avalanche or Solana, we finally can have thousands of nodes in the network, and without doing things the, you know, EOS or Tron way. But at the same time, we can guarantee that everybody who wants to become a human node will join the network, because if you have millions of people who want that, they will just stall the network. So this is something we are aiming to solve with the decentralized organization by introducing the concepts that you wanted to discuss, like those many proofs that we have, apart from proof of uniqueness and, you know, proof of living human being in front of the camera, so to say. And these are the concepts of proof of time and proof of devotion. So delving into proof of time, it's pretty easy. This is how long you actually run a node. Of course, there should be requirements for people so that we won't have 10% or 20% of the network just go offline one day, because this can cause a lot of technical issues. And that is why we are tracking how long the person is running the node correctly with the good uptime. And if the person fails, he first gets slashed. And in our world, slashing is like banning your biometric identity from validating the network's transactions for a certain period of time. Okay, and the other concept is proof of devotion. So basically, that means that if you want to join the network, and if we have a great competition of people who want to join the network, we somehow have to choose people who will be running nodes inside the network and who will be outside of the like validator subset. So we do that by tracking whether a person had his proposal approved by the decentralized organization or not, and whether he executed this proposal or not. And by using all these proofs, we eventually have a list of people who are, well, prepared to become human nodes and help us create a new distributed economy compared to all the others who want to join the network, but don't want to do anything with it, in fact, and just you know, reap the rewards.
Excellent. So circling back to the whole biometric component of it, what types of encryption technologies do you use? Because I imagine if you're capturing facial likenesses and such, that can be seen as private information, obviously needs to be protected.
Well, actually, there are five primitives that we use. And I don't want to delve into the detail of each and every of them, but I can give you a general overview what happens. So when the user first scans his face, we encrypt his biometric template. This is what comes from the neural network algorithm. And then basically in encrypted form, it's sent to the network of nodes. The thing is that when it goes through the search and matching mechanism to decide whether you're a unique person or not, simply by comparing your biometric template to all the other people, we have to encrypt each and every layer of the neural network. And for now, there are about 40 of those, because the more layers you have in the neural network, the more accurate it is. And once this process is complete, the nodes send zero knowledge proof to each other that the process of biometric search and matching was complete and it was successful, basically encrypting the score and sending the proof, was it yes or was it no, to all the other nodes. And it does the same for liveness detection. And actually, liveness detection, it has even more networks inside that the search and matching operations, because you have to check out how the light falls on the person's face, how the, you know, sometimes we also track the movement of the person's mouth. And eventually, when we will add additional layers of security, we will also ask people to smile in front of the camera, to move their head around, giving them, you know, random challenges that will help us with even more accuracy say that this is a real human being in front of the camera. Well, I would finally say that we have the whole white paper, and 20% of it is about how we encrypt the biometrics. You see, all the enterprise biometrics, they use just a honeypot where they store all the biometric templates and compare to each other, but decrypting them before comparing. And this is not how we want to do that. And this is not how things are done in crypto, because people want to stay private in crypto. That's what it's all about. And we are basically the first ones who are building the private neural network, especially designed for biometrics. Why? Because if you take the general privacy solutions like secure enclaves, that means that you have security by hardware and not cryptographically, mathematically guaranteed security and privacy of your biometrics. And the other reason for that, because it has, well, it needs more computations to carry out. And for enterprises, it means more costs. And the development of such a solution will take 5 to 10 more time than the development of regular biometric neural networks.
Excellent. And with regards to the biometrics, obviously it's done initially at validation when you're validating a node. Are those biometrics then used to authenticate every single time there's an engagement or a vote, or with regards to proof of devotion?
Well, actually, if we see any attacks like those in the network, we will require to do that every time. But there is always a trade-off between costs of those verifications and the number of verifications that you have to do. And eventually with all the partners, when we thought about how we'll do that, we came to the idea that that's enough to make it just once a month. And that's actually the only requirement we have for a node in terms of biometrics. Just once a month, you have to update your biometric template. And once a month, you again have to prove that you're a living human being. And this is mostly because the algorithm that we use keep updated every month. And we can increase the security of the network every month.
Excellent. And then shifting into the governance model for the one human, one vote, could you give us an overview of the different levels and how the proof of devotion actually factors into that model?
So I would say that Vortex, as it looks like now, is just the decentralized organization primitive that eventually any protocol could implement using our technology. Because for now, you know, proof of devotion is just the mark. Like, you have it or you don't have it. But for many, many years, we wanted to create a decentralized structure that is not based on capital, because in a sense, there is not much difference between proof of stake and just having equity in the company, right? And if you don't have money, you don't have a vote and you don't get engaged. And eventually, people without money get engaged by being specialists who have salary, and that really doesn't change the power structure at all. So what we will do later is, of course, that we won't just have proof of devotion as yes or no, but we will create more accurate algorithms to find out, I mean, how valuable was your devotion. But this will require, you know, a lot of thought and work of political scientists and economists to figure out the best way. And I think that we'll have a lot of upgrades and debates once the network is launched. For now, it's pretty simple. You just propose a solution. You write it on chain. Then you have an on-chain voting of all the human nodes. And eventually, you get that proof of devotion.
Right. And certainly that enables other models like proof of reputation. Do you want to talk a little bit about how the human node solution could help advance the ability to build a reputation of specific members and accord them a greater vote?
So as I said, for now, proof of devotion is just a tick if you've done it or not. And what I said that will be developed later, which we eventually want to call something like proof of intelligence, right, is that, yes, you will need to have a complex reputation algorithm. But we've been thinking about it for years, and we still see a lot of flaws in those things compared to when you just have yes or no, because this is highly subjective. And it's hard to control whether this reputation thing is, truthful or not, because of all the manipulations that you may have in the network. And that's why before having that proof of reputation thing, for now reputation is just based proof of devotion, yes or no, for how long you've been running the node, and for how long you participated in governance. And yeah, the thing I want to talk about a little bit later as well, because it is how we fight the voter apathy, actually, in our DAO that you can see right now. Well, great example of the failure of current protocols is when the protocol can't launch a decentralized organization because it doesn't have enough votes. And this happened many, many times in crypto.
And what do you see the solution to dealing with the tragedy of the commons where you don't have that active participation?
So our solution here is that if you do not govern at all, you are not taking into the quorum at all. So that's pretty simple. And this is what we do with our, like, it's still called proof of time in our concept, right? Because this is the time of how long you have been governing, but any person that wants to stay among the governors, he needs to vote at least 22% of the proposals. And if he doesn't do that, he gets out of the quorum. So basically, those people who have that illness of voter apathy, they are not voters anymore. As simple as that.
Excellent. And the use of the, I guess, the proof of devotion and proof of time as eliminating the conflicts of interest. I mean, sort of stemming from your what you were just talking about, the tragedy of the commons.
So, well, that's a good question. I think that there will be a lot of conflict of interest in the network. And, well, basically, eventually, if we have too many people who want to become humanoids, right? But our network capabilities do not allow for that yet. The people who are less active than the others, they even can't validate transactions on the network. And that means they're also not getting their share of fees coming through the network. So this is not like a park where every citizen can go, right? This is a little different thing where the entrance to the park is prohibited for those who, compared to others, don't do as much as those who are really devoted and who really do something for the protocol.
Right. And with regards to the way your current DAO is structured, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. It's pretty simple. So there are three things in our DAO. First, when you have the proposal, you put the proposal into the pool. So we call it the proposal pool. It's like the first stage of voting, where you either upvote or downvote the proposal. Well, any human node can do this. And we have no delegation at this stage at all. So if you vote, you vote. You have only one vote there. Basically, then the proposal gets to the vortex itself, which is where the final decision is made, where we already have delegation. So for those people who could not vote in this proposal in the proposal pool, now their vote will be counted, because if they delegated their vote while they're away for some reason, now you have like more people eventually voting through delegation. And then the proposal finally gets into the thing we call formation, because sometimes people have proposals, but they are not the ones who execute on the proposal and make it developed and, you know, make it come true. That's when those people who propose something can find team members and share the rewards that they might get for executing the proposal. One important thing about the structure of the DAO. So we have different tiers of those who participate in the DAO, depending again on those proof of time and proof of devotion. And you still have the same one person, one vote. But if you don't have a tier high enough, you can't propose on crucial matters, as, for example, the change of monetary policy or the like meta change of the DAO itself. You're just not allowed to, because you haven't been in the network and the protocol for a long enough time to understand all the caveats of, you know, changing the protocol as a whole by implementing something on those levels as the change of DAO or the change of the economic structure. And the thing is that if you propose something great in terms of those higher level changes, you still can become like the one whose proposal gets accepted, but first it has to be promoted by the person who has been long, long ago contributing to the decentralized organization. So the only change, again, the only difference between the different tiers of the members of the DAO is the right to propose on crucial matters. And we have those four tiers to control that newcomers can really do something if they want to, but eventually we won't get stupid proposals even in the DAO because they won't go through the proposal pool.
So what about FATH? Could you explain what FATH is and the economics of FATH?
Sure. First of all, I'd like to tell you why this word. It comes from the word fathom, and it actually means why something happened. So we were looking into the history of economics and the monetary policies. Actually, I think that the macroeconomics is the least developed science in the world. And well, billions are suffering because of that every day. So when we were exploring the topic of the currency devaluation, the topic that, you know, is broadly covered by crypto market, but we still have that devaluation actually. And the thing about the devaluation is that when your economy is growing, for sure you need new money coming into the economy to account for the value growth. Otherwise, the prices of the products will always go up. And you can't live in it because it's a deflationary economy. Okay, so, I mean, why would you buy something today if it will be cheaper tomorrow? Why would you create a business that will create a product in 3 months, but in 3 months it costs already less than it was like when you started creating it? You can't live in the system like that. That's why you do have to print money, but you can't print money for the sake of the growth of the economy when it falls down. I mean, there should be always a reason to create, and, you know, to create the monetary supply and to grow the monetary supply. So we found out that economies did very well, and there was almost no devaluation of people, meaning that their purchasing power was at least stable, not falling down. Only when the printing of the creation of new monetary supply was after the economic growth. And if your monetary supply growth is higher, the rates of it are higher than the growth of the economy, well, your people are in trouble. And the purchasing power of the regular farmer or soldier fell down drastically. And sometimes people don't mention that because they are active economic agents just for 30 to 50 years in their life. But if you look at it over the course of hundreds of years, well, the numbers will be awful. And we are really convinced that food would be pretty much free if we had proper macroeconomic policies throughout the history. So the thing about FATH, well, I'm talking about FATH, you know, on the national scale here, because this is how it was first developed in our heads.
Can I actually pause on the food being free? Is that assuming that the state would be, I mean, obviously farmers and such, the producers would have to be incentivized to produce it. So would that mean that it would effectively be a state-covered good?
Well, it will be almost free compared to like 30, 50% of salary that people spend today on food. They would spend like a small fraction, 3 to 5% on food. If everything was done the other way around, but as I told, well, macroeconomics is the least developed science in the world, and there wasn't such a science 200 years ago. Well, what we're talking about here is the devaluation effect of the regular people when the monetary supply grows enormously. And what happened last year, it was like the last thing that could happen is that now if you're a bank, you can keep 0% of the reserves in your bank and give out credits right and left to everybody without any reserves. And that's when you have the, well, the most horrible devaluation effect on regular people. So let's now get back to crypto. The thing is that, things are different in crypto, but you still have the devaluation of the holdings of regular people who buy Bitcoin, by those who mine Bitcoin, right? Or by those who stake any proof of stake coin or delegate it. So it doesn't cure the thing. And what we came up with is that imagine that you have GDP in the country, right? If you have GDP in the country, why can't you have the GDP of the crypto network? I mean, this is all the goods and products sold in the network for 1 year. So you take this number. Actually, it's pretty easy to count when your network has special purposes like ours. It's an EVM-compatible network, so you can run smart contracts on it and pay the fees for the smart contracts. And at the same time, it's a crypto biometric network which processes biometrics. And basically, this is the product and the output of the network, total fees collected by the network. So if you take that number in the year one, and you take that number in the year two, and compare them to each other, you will find out whether you had the growth of production of your network or the fall of production of your network. So the most stupid thing that happens in our world is that when we have the fall of GDP of the country, the cure for it right now is having more monetary supply in order to keep the economy going. And that what brings the devaluation. Because if you have less goods and products flowing through the economy, you don't need that much money anymore. And you actually have to shrink the monetary supply. As we are now living in the crypto world, of course, we can create, you know, the self-auditable system which tracks all the smart contracts that you have and all the operations in the network and count that number. And then what we do is that if the economy of the crypto network grew, we would rebalance every account of the protocol by that amount. So again, if, for example, we call it gross network product increased by 2%, that means that if you had 100 tokens on your wallet, it will be rebalanced and you will have 102 tokens on your wallet. So what we say here is that, well, you can actually see it as helicopter money, because everybody gets those money, right? And everybody gets them proportionally, depending on how much you have at the moment. And the other thing about it is that when you have the fall of the output of your network in the second year, we will shrink the monitor supply by that number, and each and every balance will decrease by that percent, because you have to shrink your monetary supply if your economy fell down. I hope I'm pretty clear here, but you can ask any questions. It's not clear yet.
No, on some level, it strikes me as being somewhat similar to modulating supply and demand in like seigniorage, right? Like in a seigniorage model for a currency. The seigniorage holders would have to buy when the economy is contracting and sell when the economy is expanding to maintain the peg. Is that sort of similar in concept?
Well, I would say it's a bit different, because actually, I don't think that a pegged currency is something you can have stable, because if your economy falls down, you will have to support the peg, eventually losing all you have. So what we have here is, I would call it an anti-peg, because, well, if your economy is falling, that means that, well, actually what it makes eventually, it's making the prices more stable in the economy. So in that sense, you're right. Yeah. Because for every product you have the same amount of money at any given year.
Right. It's similar to if the GDP is growing, that means there's a lot of demand for the monetary supply and you're issuing
exactly
into it.
Yeah.
Instead of requiring purchases, you're basically issuing more to facilitate the supply.
Yep.
Whereas if the economy is shrinking, you're effectively burning it so that there's not as much demand for it. And by burning it, you're creating more demand for the currency that remains.
Yep. And the final goal is to have the currency, I mean, that has 100% reserve ratio. And at the same time, to be able not to fall either into superinflation or into deflationary system, and keep prices for the same amount of goods as stable as possible. And if the economy has the stable productivity growth rate, that means that eventually your monetary supply will be always be rebalanced around that productivity growth, because that's the only long-term real growth that we have in the economy.
Right. Interesting. How would it work with a crypto project or a token that came to you and said, we want to work with you to deploy the FATH model? Would you work in conjunction with that token to apply those economics to their ecosystem, so to speak?
The thing is that it is impossible to implement such a model if you have a network based on like proof of stake or proof of work. Because for those, you would always need block rewards to keep the network running. And block rewards mean that some part of token holders always get devalued by the others. You see, so actually Humanode for now is the only network that is capable of supporting such an economy where there is no actor who gets devalued by the system, right? Essentially creating a gap between those who are at the top, being validators, decision makers, and at the bottom. You will always have an outflow of capital from those on the lower level to those on the upper level. And that's how current cryptocurrency works. So I'm completely right. Sure that it's impossible, you know, to go from proof of stake to something like FATH without completely changing how the network works and without having the network where one human equals one node.
Got it. Actually, if you could help explain the relationship between FATH and Vortex and how it is only possible to have FATH on Vortex or on a human node type network.
Well, again, it is only possible just because of the fact that to keep the capital-based network running, you need to have the rewards for those who run the network. In Humanode, we also have the rewards, but they're not just coming out of some number of tokens that we reserved for the next 100 years in order to pay out those rewards. No, it doesn't work like that. Because in Humanode, we came up with something we call the cost-based fee system. And that's why we don't need block rewards. So when you have the network where all the nodes are equal, that means that every node incurs pretty much the same cost for running the node, right? And you don't have all of those differences in how many blocks do I validate compared to how many blocks you validate and the difference in rewards. You don't have it all. That's why what we can do is that at any given moment in time, we can find out the actual costs for running the node. There is the computation part of it and there is storage part of it. So we will take the data through oracles directly from, for example, cloud service provider, right? And we can have those numbers in dollars. Then we will say, okay, if you want to send a transaction on the Humanode network, you just pay for the costs, the computation and storage of the nodes that they incurred for, you know, running that transaction. You will ask me, where is the incentive here to run a human node, right? Where is the economic reason to become one? And the reason is pretty simple, because when you send a transaction, you pay for the perpetual storage because blockchain stores your data forever, right? And you have to pay it upfront, as it always happens in current networks. But if you look at those who run the nodes, they don't pay for, you know, forever to store your data on the cloud provider, right? They pay at the exact moment of time. And the difference between those two numbers is actually the incentive to run a human node. And until there are at least two human nodes in the network will still guarantee that this data is stored forever.
Right. And in addition to even just the cost of storage, there's also implicit in that is the cost of security, which a lot of analysts have stated that, you know, basically security, you know, the ongoing maintenance of security isn't often built into the upfront transaction fees.
Well, I would say that if you have a crypto biometric network, the quality of your biometrics is the security of your network.
So the actual security cost of the Humanoid network is continuous development of the crypto biometric technology and the continuous increase in accuracy of those biometrics. And if we talk about the network that has the accuracy like we are having now, because, you know, we have different biometric providers who've been working for years already to become more accurate than what you have on your Android or your Apple device. And I mean, the accuracy is 100 times higher. If you count the costs of attacking such a network, because spoofing identity is really costly and almost impossible, you will have the number of billions of dollars, which compares only to top 40 proof of stake networks. And this is what we already have now. And this number, I mean, the accuracy of biometrics increases at least twofold each year if you look at 10-year time frame. So if the protocol still has money and resources to carry on the development and the upgrades of the network, that means that security grows every year.
Excellent. So looking ahead, let's talk about, I guess, both the economic model and biometrics, maybe starting with biometrics. What do you see as the future for notion of human verification, validation, you know, the liveness? You know, how do you see it impacting the whole crypto space? Because arguably, in certain networks, it's going to be more critical to be able to value that human participation than others, but it really doesn't exist today so much. So how do you see it impacting the whole digital asset space and the whole, basically, the decentralized system, ecosystem?
So I would say that biometrics is the most viable way to finally connect our physical bodies with what we have in the digital space. You have, other approaches like building social graphs where one person should validate another person. But only biometrics are, you know, pseudonymous and have much higher accuracy that don't allow, for us to collude and cheat the network.
Do you think like social graphs, which incidentally we actually did do an episode with Janiel Thacker from CoinVise a while that covered social graphs. Do you think social graphs could actually be combined?
Yeah, with, sure.
Yeah,
sure.
That would probably, that would basically certify the reputation, like then indeed it's the same person with that reputation. And then you attach a social graph. And so that would allow somebody to have a much higher degree of assurances that in fact, the person with that social graph was in fact the same person. And
that's actually what Kevin from Gitcoin is already doing, because he creates a framework for digital passport where the person in his digital passport can have all those ways of authorization to have, you know, a higher level of proof that he's the same unique human being. So, of course, the combination of those, and if you look at the network security, I won't say that Humanoid will eventually replace all the proof-of-stake protocols, but if you have the security of both of the worlds, you have the most secure network. So, and if you look at the crypto space, basically biometrics is something that crypto space is really missing right now. And we're happy to become pretty much the first crypto biometric company in the space. And as we see, well, everybody needs that, from DeFi protocols where you can do the credit scoring to decentralized social networks that for sure need to somehow fight the bots because they can just ban people like current social networks do. And of course, there is a big problem. Yes, you can have a decentralized organization that is completely based on stake. But if you have DAO-to-DAO communication, you have to open up a new channel, not based on stake, because these are two different networks, right? And that's when the biometric technology comes handy as well. I mean, we can talk about use cases for hours. New popping up every week. I think we have a list of more than 20 of those. But first of all, this is cyber resistance for those protocols who need it, like from poker to social networks. And then it's DAO, new kind of DAOs, who will finally have greater community inclusion than those apathic networks we have right now.
Right. And when you think about things like social tokens or tokens that are built around communities, you know, where the people who are engaged, you know, it's important to know who they are. And it's important to make sure that you're not getting, you're not being DDoSed, or you're not having people who are, you know, basically getting excluded and then popping up again under a different pseudonymous identity or anonymous identity. Certainly the biometrics would be key in ensuring that you can effectively trust that community and that the people you think are engaged are in fact the people who are engaged. So excellent. And then in terms of FATH, what do you see as the future of FATH? How do you see it sort of playing out on a side-by-side basis with other token offerings and token economics out there?
Well, frankly speaking, I don't know how it will work out for the other token economies, but because we're the first one to conduct that experiment and we'll see how it goes. Eventually, what FATH can allow you to do is to create a network that, an economy that has stable growth without the, if you look at current like macroeconomic situation, it really looks like pump and dump. And FATH doesn't allow that to happen because it's a rule-based monetary policy. And I really hope one day to see one country to implement something like FATH.
Right. I mean, I would think with a lot of token projects, you're relying on their burning when there's too much supply and issuing when there's not enough. But in the absence of a defined rule around it, what's the visibility, you know, in it? So to the extent that you're establishing hard and fast rules that are objective and always initiate, it does provide sort of a clear path forward.
Yep, and it does align the incentives of those people who come to the network, because everybody understands that if we don't make this network grow, we will have, you know, our balances decreased after 1 year.
Excellent. So this was a great episode. Before we go, is there anything that I didn't ask you about that, you know, I should have?
Well, we were thinking a lot, you know, that when I graduated from the university, I spent the whole year just sitting at home reading. And I was, and I still am a big fan of the different theories on the general artificial intelligence, because I do think that eventually it will come to the level where it will take a lot of work that we're now doing. And, you know, all the economic optimizations that we're doing with economists. And the question is, how can we create that general artificial intelligence without losing control over it? If you have a capital-based network, well, we will lose pretty quickly, right? It will just create a lot of mining equipment and capture the Bitcoin network. That's it. We're done. In proof of stake, it just buys us out. Okay. So eventually, if you think about it, that if you want to have the control over the general artificial intelligence or many of those that we might have in the future, the only thing for people to stay in control is a solution like Humanoid, where the network belongs to people. And well, another thing is the economy, which is not captured by those who have money. The only way to have, you know, the decentralized social structure or even a governmental structure that is not captured only by those, and to have the co-ownership of these social structures that we have, is to have a way to prove that, well, this is one human, he's unique, he's a living human being, that's why he has the same voice as everybody else, and he controls that structure with the same power as everybody else.
Right, based on contribution and not just pure capital. So, yep, excellent. Exactly. Well, Victor, a lot of things to think about, and it's going to be very interesting to see how biometric validation becomes more important in some of the decentralized networks that we're building. So thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Eric. Don't forget that there are already 50 human nodes running on the testnet, and anybody can try and become one.
Excellent. Well, I'll have to make sure we get the right links in the podcast as well, in the show notes.
Okay.